accession number 19661, Real 1.
Jock Fowlis, Real 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Blackpool.
Which year was this?
1929.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Blackpool?
Initially I grew up in Blackpool, and then I went off to boarding school in Derbyshire at the age of 14, having failed, in fact, to get in the Navy at that point.
Why did you want to go in the Navy?
I have no idea why I wanted to go in the Navy, except that I always have and still have a love of the sea and ships, and I'm happy on a ship doing whatever I may be doing.
Can you tell me about your Second World War memories, please?
I remember certain things vividly. I always remember, and I'm reminded of it, of course, quite recently, of the speech when war was declared by Neville Chamberlain. And that brings back to me the memories. I can see the family now. I had a sister, and we were sitting in the sitting room. My mother was sewing blackout curtains and listening to Neville Chamberlain at 11:15 on that Sunday morning, telling us that we were at war with Germany. My father was a special constable, having joined in 1938, and he went through the war commanding a division of special constabulary in Blackpool.
Was there any question of your being evacuated?
No, it was the other way round. We had an evacuee for a time from Manchester, because Manchester Grammar School came to Blackpool, and we were given one of the boys from there. He didn't stay that long, as was the case with so many of the evacuees, I think, at the time. But we were spared any real bombing. We had the odd bomb, which was an overflow from Barrow-in-Furness or Liverpool or Manchester, because the bombing runs appeared to come over Blackpool and that area from both, or from these three places. So we get the odd bomb, the odd shower of incendiaries from time to time.
How did the evacuee boy fit in?
He fitted in very well. He was about the same age as my sister, who was a wee bit older than me. And he fitted in extremely well. He came from the same sort of home, I think.
What was Blackpool like in the Second World War?
It was full of mainly RAF. It was, first of all, an RAF basic training centre. And all the boarding houses and private hotels, for which Blackpool is famous, were full of airmen doing their recruit training. The promenade was full of squads drilling, doing PT and things like that. So we were full of them. We also got an awful lot of Polish Air Force at one stage. These were the main two elements. Because of this, it was a very lively town, and entertainment and so on seemed to me to go on as it always had. It probably wasn't quite like that, but as a child you don't notice it.
Did the servicemen in Blackpool cause any trouble, or were they well behaved?
Don't remember them causing any trouble at all, no. I think if there had been trouble, I'd have probably heard about it, with my father being a special police, and he was out on duty an awful lot in the evening. And I never recall any instance of him coming home and saying, oh, we had terrible trouble, this, that or the other. So I would say they caused no trouble at all.
Any POWs in the area?
Not that I remember, no.
Was your schooling at all affected by the war?
I don't think so. I mean, obviously, teachers weren't quite the same as before the war. You had the old and the half-retired. I remember we had a German Jewish refugee, Dr. Steinitz, I think was his name, who taught German. We had women teachers, probably for the first time in a public school. I had a very good maths mistress, I remember. So in this respect, it was different, but I don't think it affected the quality of the education at all.
What was the name of your school?
Repton, which is just outside Derby.
Was there any air attack in the Repton area?
I never saw or heard anything. I find it hard to believe that Derby wasn't attacked at some stage, partly because of the Rolls Royce, of course. But I don't recall any incident of that sort at all.
Did you suffer any privation in the Second World War?
No. Food was short, but one got used to it. Rationing was there. I mean, one grew up with it. I was 9, 10 when the war broke out. And one just grew up with the rationing and accepted it. And one seemed to be perfectly healthy.
Any celebrations you remember at the end of the war?
Not very vividly. V-Day, May, I must have been at school, I think. V-Day I must have been at school, VJ Day I was probably at home. It was probably VE Day, we were given the day off, and the only thing I remember about it is that I and a chum cycled from Repton to Nottingham that day, because we were allowed to go and do what we pleased, which was slightly unusual in a boarding school in those days, and we had our bicycles, and we got on our bicycles and we cycled to Nottingham, and various other places around about there. I can't remember what we did, but that seemed to be our way of celebrating the end of the war.
Had you followed the course of the war march?
Oh, very closely, yes. Another thing which I was always interested in was aeroplanes. Again, I don't know why. So I followed that side of the war, the development of aircraft, subject which I still take quite an interest in all through the war. And I remember I took a weekly magazine called the Aeroplane Spotter, which was a cheap version of the Aeroplane magazine and was devoted to aircraft recognition to a large extent. And I regularly read that and followed the air war perhaps more than any other.
Had you been in doubt about the outcome of the war?
I don't think so, no. I think the propaganda was fairly good.
How did you come to be in the army yourself?
I decided to join the army fairly early on. As I commented before, I failed to get in the navy at the age of 14. This was because of my eyesight, which was, and always had been, very bad. I was short-sighted. So I failed the Dartmouth Medical. My father had been in the army in the First World War, as had most of his brothers. He had three other brothers. And we had this connection with Scottish regiments. I knew, of course, that I would have to go in the army anyway as a national serviceman, or during the war, if it still went on, as a conscript. And always thought of myself as going into a Scottish regiment. I suppose it grew on me, and by the time I was 16, 17, I had firmly decided that the army was a career for me. There was, in fact, one slight problem, and that was I was below the eyesight standard for a regular commission at the time. However, I was rather lucky, because I remember we had a party at home one Sunday lunchtime, a drinks party, and one of our neighbours came in, and he was an optician who worked in Lytham St Anne's, and he and a specialist in London In these early days, we're talking about 1946, I think, were the only two people in the United Kingdom who dealt with contact lenses. They were a very primitive form of contact lens, and they had between them written the textbook on the subject. I was talking to him and told him about my problem, purely in passing, and he said, come and see me tomorrow in my shop. So I went down. He said, I will fit you up with contact lenses. I think that should get you in the army. He was perfectly right. I went for my medical to what was then the British Military Hospital in Birmingham, because I went from Repton. And I went through a very intense full medical with various specialists looking at various parts of my body, including an eye specialist who looked at my eyes, and he peered into my eyes with one of these little torches that they have and pronounced me 100% fit and never noticed that I was wearing contact lenses. I therefore passed the medical with flying colours and went into the army.
When was this?
This was 1947.
Had your parents been born in Scotland?
My father was a Scot, my mother was English.
Whereabouts in Scotland was your father?
He came from Dundee and worked for a famous newspaper man called D.C. Thompson of Dundee, and in fact in Blackpool was working for the local paper.
So you weren't keen on the Gordon Highlanders or some such thing?
I was supposed to go in the Black Watch. I'd had uncles in the Black Watch, and one of the Thompson family, one of D.C. Thompson's sons, was in fact at that time commanding a reformed battalion, TA battalion of the Black Watch, and sponsored me to go into the Black Watch from Sandhurst. I in fact joined the army as a private in the Black Watch, went to Sandhurst as Black Watch, but in fact was commissioned into the KOSB.
What did you think of the Sandhurst course?
It was very thorough, it was very good. The one important part of it, which I found followed me right through my career, was the emphasis in those days which they placed on administration, which may seem rather pedestrian, but I quickly learned that it was probably one of the most important sides of a military career. And as my first CO once said, that if you got the administration right, the battalion could do anything. If you got the administration wrong, the whole thing would collapse. And this, funnily enough, was stressed very much in those days at Sandhurst.
So what was the secret of being a good administrator?
I suppose attention to detail, to put it in a word. It's too easy to say that that will look after itself, or that will look after itself, or this always happens, so it will this time. Of course, none of these things happen, and therefore you've got to pay attention to them, you've got to get them right.
And after Sandhurst?
After Sandhurst, say I was commissioned in the KOSB. They were at that time serving in Hong Kong, the 1st Battalion. So I went to the Lowland Brigade Training Battalion, which was in Edinburgh and was in fact the 1st Battalion of the Royal Scots, where one was held while one did courses at the School of Infantry. One could do either a small arms course or a platoon commander's course. There wasn't time to do both, because the army was short of officers, regular officers at the time. I went to Hythe and did the small arms course, then back to Edinburgh to await shipping out to Hong Kong, because of course all trooping in those days was by sea. So in due course I sailed from Southampton on a troop ship called the Empire Foy, which was an ex-German liner for Hong Kong, a voyage which took 4 weeks plus, just about, calling in Gibraltar, Malta, Portside, Aden, Colombo, Singapore, and then Hong Kong. So quite a tour of that part of the world. You got ashore at all these places because you had to take on fresh water. In those days, ships didn't make their own fresh water. So you had to take on fresh water at all these ports, and you had to take on fuel, of course.
What was your job with the battalion in Hong Kong?
My first job was platoon commander, basic job in an infantry battalion. I was sent to a company who had a very fine platoon company commander at the time, and began to learn my job commanding a platoon. Platoon nominally of about 30 men. In Hong Kong in 1950 it was, platoon, you were lucky, consisted of 10 men. We were very under strength, as were so many battalions at the time. We were in Hong Kong to fight off the Chinese if they came across the border. 40 div had gone out to Hong Kong as the communists took over in China, and there were three brigades, 27, 28 and X. I'm not quite sure why X, and we were 28 brigade. But as I say, we were all very under strength, and we spent our time digging defences in the hills up on the border between the new territories and China.
Did you see anything of the communists?
No, we didn't. The border was through paddy fields, in fact. There are paddy fields on both sides of the border. It was a high barbed wire fence, and on our side, the Hong Kong police had a number of police stations. We went up to these police stations at night. We used to send a couple of police stations. We used to send a detachment to at night, consisting of a jeep, an officer, and a signaller. Our job was to inform the powers that be if the Chinese army crossed the frontier. Whether we'd have been able to do it, and what good it would have done, we were never quite convinced, but that's what we were there for. And we never saw anything except the occasional refugee. The Hong Kong police used to patrol this barbed wire fence at night, and the refugees used to try and tunnel through it. And any that got through to our side would be promptly arrested by the police and brought back to the police station. So really, those were the only Chinese we saw from the other side of the fence.
Did you at all imagine at any stage whilst you were in Hong Kong that the communists might intervene in the colony?
We were always being told that they would. And I think there was a real fear that they would, because nobody had any idea what they were going to do. As I say, when they were only just coming onto the border at that time, we had a brigadier, a new brigadier, not long after I arrived, who was a very brave man from the Second World War. He had three DSOs to his name, but he was something of a fire eater, and I shall always remember the day just after his arrival when he came to address the battalion, all assembled on the square, and he stood up and told us how these Chinese hordes were about to descend upon us, and that we would be overrun, that we would die fighting to the last man and the last bullet, and the river would run with the blood of the Chinese who were assaulting us. We thought he was a slightly strange man at the time, but that was him, and that was the way he viewed the situation at the time.
How did you and your men like or dislike serving in Hong Kong?
Difficult question to answer, but because I can't really remember anything very positive about it. I can only say that I can't believe that the soldiers enjoyed it very much. Our camp, when I arrived, was tented. It was a permanent camp. We all lived in tents, and the tents were pitched in dried out paddy fields. We were had no private transport there, and the only way of getting into civilization, as you might say, Kowloon or Hong Kong, was in military transport. So there wasn't really much that the soldiers could do, and very little more that the officers could do. We were allowed to go downtown occasionally, although my first month in the camp, I didn't see the bright lights of Hong Kong. The story being that I arrived in the battalion and was put in charge of another subaltern who would show me the ropes, another subaltern in my company. And the following morning, I was told we were going on a recce with the commanding officer, who was a very strict and, in fact, subsequently, I'd say probably the best commanding officer I'd ever had, but a very strict officer, very rigid. And we were going on a recce with him at 8 o'clock in the morning, and we were to meet at the guardroom. As we approached the guardroom, this supervisor of mine and myself, we were greeted at about 50 yards range by a stentorian voice, the commanding officer, saying, "Why are you late?" We didn't think we were late, and we looked at our watches, and by our watches we were probably about a minute early. But you didn't argue with the commanding officer, and in fact he didn't really give us time to argue, because he followed up his "why are you late" with the phrase, "You are both confined to camp for 28 days. So I achieved what is probably a record of being confined to camp for 28 days when I hadn't been in the battalion for 24 hours. So I spent my first 28 days in the paddy fields, in my tent. But that is how you learn your job, I suppose, and how you learn that you aren't late when you're told to parade at a certain time. I think I can safely say that to this day I have never been less than 5 minutes early for any appointment which has been made for me.
Why do you think he behaved in such a way?
He was a very old-fashioned officer in his idea of discipline and similar matters. For example, he could have had his wife in Hong Kong at the time. There were no married quarters or anything like that, but you were allowed to bring your wife out at your own cost. But Colonel John would not have his wife in Hong Kong. As he put it, she would only interfere with him doing his job of commanding the battalion. He was totally single-minded about commanding his battalion, having an efficient, fit, trained battalion, something which paid absolute dividends, as we were to discover not very long afterwards.
So your estimate was that he was a good CO?
I have never had a finer CO in my life.
Did you resent the punishment?
Probably.
Any other memories of Hong Kong and life there?
One didn't see a lot of it in that in the period before we went to Korea. We didn't have the money. I was earning 13 shillings a day. So by the time you paid your mess subs and for your food, there wasn't a lot of that left. As I say, there was no way of getting down to town, really, except perhaps on a Saturday you would be offered a jeep, which was going in, which would take you in and bring you back. So we didn't get downtown very often. We made our fun amongst ourselves, which was probably be considered very dull today. But
what did that consist of?
Talking, listening to music, drinking when we could do it out of the sight of the commanding officer, because again, he didn't approve of his young officers drinking. In fact, if one wanted to buy a bottle of whiskey from the mess bar to take away, the mess sergeant would very obligingly put it down on your mess bill as a crate of orange aid, so that the commanding officer, on inspecting the bill book, wouldn't see that you'd had a bottle of whiskey.
Was Colonel John then a teetotaler?
Very nearly. I don't think he was actually teetotal, but he was very strict.
What kind of disciplinary problems did you have with the men?
Drink, mainly. We had a lot of old soldiers amongst the junior NCOs. I had three. I shall never forget them. Corporals Roberts, Todd and Catley. They'd all got service in the Second World War, so they were far more experienced than I was. Roberts had been in the Commandos. The other two had served in various battalions of the regiment. And they were, in every sense of the word, old soldiers. And when they were off duty, they tended to drink. And all sorts of problems would come up. One would sleep in the morning, and of course you would immediately charge him for being absent from parade. And the three musketeers, as you might call them, the other two would promptly ask to hand in their stripes and revert to the ranks because you'd arrested one or charged one of them. This happened with all three in turn with monotonous regularity. You always managed to persuade them to retain their stripes. Occasionally, one of them would be reduced to lance corporal, but they were such good NCOs, in fact, that they very quickly got the stripe back again. But these were the sort of old soldiers that one had as junior NCOs. Very experienced, but fairly hard living. Most of the soldiers, of course, were national servicemen and relative youngsters. You had a few regulars, but not very many. But drink, yes, that was the main problem, because there wasn't much else for them to do as recreation.
You didn't have any problem with their associating with women in Hong Kong?
If they got near them, yes. But as I say, the chances at that time of getting contact weren't that great, although there was a very, very heavy rate of venereal disease in the army in Hong Kong at that time. And of course, the closer you were to civilization, probably the higher the rate. There was one battalion which shall remain nameless, which had a rate, an annual rate of venereal disease of 110% of the battalion. 110% of the battalion. In fact, at one stage, the divisional commander was so worried about it that he ordered monthly in divisional orders they would publish the number of cases, new cases in battalion each month. Some people maintained, however, this was counterproductive and that some regiments, probably the Scottish ones, aimed to be top of the league rather than the bottom. This is probably apocryphal, but never mind, it makes a good story.
How is it possible to have 110%?
Well, if they all get it once and 10% get it twice,